Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. My guest today is Professor Hadi Dolatabadi from the UBC Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability and the Liu Institute for Global Change. He is UBC's interdisciplinary poster child. In the words of his students, after the completion of a PhD in physics at Cambridge University in 1984, Dr. Dolatabadi has made a career of branching out from his rigorous and creative scholarship and has challenged orthodox views and advanced the state of the art in the understanding of the impacts of climate change, communicable and vector-borne diseases, technology choice, and policy design. He is widely recognized for the development of integrated assessment methods that provide a general toolkit for investigating interdisciplinary problems rife with complexity and uncertainty. Dr. Hadi Dolatabadi is the epitome of interdisciplinarity. This is Prof Talk. It is a real pleasure to have Hadi Dolatabadi on the show today. He's also a jointly appointed faculty member of the UBC College of Interdisciplinary Studies, which was founded in 2007 to support collaborative interdisciplinary research and teaching addressing complex societal issues engaging local, national, and international communities. Dr. Dolatabadi's own research involves issues surrounding equity in world energy markets and implications for climate policy, and more broadly, the cognitive and organizational aspects of how we understand and interact with the world around us. Since interdisciplinary approaches typically focus on problems felt by researchers to be too complex or vast to be dealt with within the knowledge and tools of a single discipline, I began a conversation with Dr. Dolatabadi about why it was so important to research topics that cut across traditional boundaries and view them in an integrated way, and how his own work is attempting to do this. I also asked him about what often hinders students in the social and natural sciences to make those interdisciplinary connections. Have a listen.
Well, thanks for having me here. And I think I won the poster child prize because there were no other candidates. Everyone else takes themselves too seriously. The reason I think interdisciplinary research is important is because the real-world problems don't come to the university's edge and say, I actually belong to this discipline or that discipline. Real-world problems cross disciplinary boundaries, and we've organized our own learning processes according to disciplinary traditions, which are attractive intrinsically, but from my perspective, limiting in terms of solving real-world problems. So that's why I think interdisciplinarity is important. Every project I'm doing involves bringing together knowledge from different fields. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So we're working on, for example, the issue of justice in climate and how climate change and justice need to be integrated in order for us to get a little bit further in addressing the challenges that face us. Well, that brings together the science of climate change, the need to understand the distribution of impacts of climate change, understanding of economics and what it takes to mitigate the drivers of climate change, and understanding of where the implications of the distribution of burden for mitigation is going to lie. It also requires understanding applied philosophy and ethics, because you need to understand concepts of justice and how different people might view a just solution. You also need to understand law and procedures, because for many people, the rules themselves are not as important as the processes by which we come to decisions. So the rules for deciding a burden are not as important as being seen to be fair in the process of coming up with a decision. So you need to bring all of that together, which is psychology and sociology, and all of that needs to come together for you to have a coherent approach towards addressing the simple question of how do we establish justice in the climate response field. You know how real estate agents say location, location, location? My motto is respect, respect, respect. You have to respect your colleagues who are experts in other areas. You have to respect their methods. You have to respect the approach they take, the fact that they're spending time with you. All of those are only possible if you respect them and they're willing to get out of their shell. Because from a disciplinarian's perspective, any time spent outside your discipline is risky, right? You might have publications that your traditional journals won't, public submissions, manuscripts that your traditional journals won't accept. Or your colleagues would poo-poo because it's not hard enough or, cutting edge enough within your own discipline. So what you need is to recognize that these collective efforts from involving people from different disciplines are actually quite risky. And the academics who engage in them are being brave in trying to pursue real-world solutions to problems that don't follow disciplinary boundaries. What they're actually doing is they're saying they're going beyond what their traditions have required. And that's what I try to do, is to kind of honor them for that and to try and make sure that the questions are compelling enough to engage them and that the system rewards them for their sacrifice, because that's what it really does involve, sacrifice. You could easily engage in, a year and a half of research in a collective that leads to a paper, whereas if you were working on your own, you would be publishing 3 or 4 papers. And unfortunately, what happens is when it comes to tenure decisions and promotion decisions and so on, people don't have a sense of how hard it was to collaborate, but how many papers you published. So those are all sacrifices that interdisciplinarians often have to take on in order to feel the rewards of interdisciplinary work. I was coming to finish my PhD and I realized that all the job opportunities I had would either be related to military or other applications of my knowledge that I'm not so keen on kind of working for. So I decided to kind of retrain myself in energy, because I thought, energy systems are addressing needs, and if you could understand energy systems and how we could provide energy services more effectively, that would be a social benefit that could also employ me, right? So I wanted to make sure I'm socially useful. As soon as I got comfortable with that, I realized that energy production willy-nilly has environmental impacts. Now, it could be acid rain, it could be climate change, it could be any number of things. And so very early on, I realized that I also needed to become familiar with environmental sciences associated with not the energy production, but the externalities of energy production. As soon as I grew familiar with that, I realized that now what I'm missing in terms of my own toolkit is economics. Mm-hmm. Because somehow you have to reflect the adverse impacts of energy production in terms of social and environmental impacts in the decision-making for energy production, and that required economics. And as soon as that became available to me, I grew comfortable with that. I realized that you have to combine all of these things, and now psychology, and now sociology, and now law. And all of those things go hand in hand in order to make a decision, for example, about how to repower the heating system for UBC, right? Because we're in a community, we need to bring our energy resources to serve the needs of the community. How should those needs be met is both an engineering problem and a social problem and an environmental problem and an economic problem, and and the combination of all of that is a necessary approach. When you come to solve problems like climate change, you're dealing with impacts, say, in ecosystems. Well, you need to bring in an ecosystem specialist in order to augment your skills, because, you know, soon you're not able to kind of absorb all of this, and so on. Sociologists, First Nations specialists, if you're dealing with the Arctic communities and their plight with respect to climate change, all of those need to be brought in. And so your team of interdisciplinary colleagues grows, and with it, you both become better equipped to address these challenges, and you become acquainted with different approaches to problem solving. And so in interdisciplinary research, you really gain two benefits. One is domain expertise in areas outside of your own domains of familiarity. You know, so First Nations specialists can tell me about cultural issues related to First Nations and how they view their environment. But beyond that, their methods for engaging First Nations or reflecting their challenges and so on are methods that, say, a physicist wouldn't be familiar with.
Right.
And so what you end up being able to do is to use the best of the methods from all the different domains that you brought together. You know, one of the interesting aspects of interdisciplinary work is the relative difficulty of natural sciences and social sciences kind of understanding one another. And one of the things that's not really well appreciated is that it's really easy to do natural sciences because the boundaries are so clear. So, for example, if I'm studying a problem in physics, depending on the scale that I'm looking at, you know, is it the scale of a planet or the scale of electrons, the forces that dominate are absolutely clear, right? If it's scale of planets, it's gravity. If it's electrons, it's electromagnetism. That's not at all the case in the social sciences. What you have is this overlapping influence from lots of different scales. So let's say you're interested in studying why I chose a particular vehicle. Look, there is individual psychology, there is the society, there is the economy. Everything interacts before that decision emerges. And each of those disciplines can claim preeminence in shaping that decision, whereas, in fact, it is a combination of all of them. So whereas it's really interesting that we use the terminology of hard sciences and soft sciences to distinguish natural and social sciences respectively, I actually think it's exactly the other way around. That the hard one is the one in which there isn't clear boundaries between different lenses that look at a problem. And the easy one is the one in which the problem structure and the disciplines have actually been organized to allow you to compartmentalize the relative importance of the kind of dominant force in whatever system that you're looking at. And so whenever it comes to interdisciplinary work, you really have to respect how difficult it is for the social scientists to kind of get their arms around the problem, and how easy it is for the natural scientists to do that. But it's the social scientists who are doing the hard work, and the natural scientists have it easy.
We then began a conversation about Arctic Canada, where some of the most significant climate changes are expected to occur. In a paper that Dr. Dolot Abadi co-authored with doctoral student Michelle Boyle, they state that early and significant climate changes are expected in the Arctic, including sea ice reduction, permafrost degradation, more hazardous weather, and alternations in biological systems, with disproportionate impacts to indigenous populations who depend on climate-sensitive resources.
Arctic regions in general are expected to experience the greatest climate change and consequently probably the greatest ecological impacts from that climate change. And Arctic communities traditionally have been highly reliant on their ecosystems for their livelihoods. They're not anymore. But it is a defining characteristic of their culture. Amongst the defining characteristics of their culture. One of the things that this research aimed to look into and has shown is that there is a tendency to put the sled before the dog in an analogy relevant to the North of recognizing climate change as a big issue and then assuming that addressing climate change is the biggest issue facing Arctic communities. One of the truly sad aspects of our lives today is that the plights of First Nations have been mostly unaddressed. And when we go off to the Arctic and focus on climate change, it's one of those cases of environmental imperialism that would be best for us to try and avoid. By saying that we care about climate change, we're implying that we don't care about the problems that face them on a day-to-day basis, which are housing and public health and education and loss of identity and, a very unstable economy and very unstable social structures. One of the benefits of doing the research in the Arctic with Michelle Boyle, it's her PhD, was that it, I think, allows us to try and put the priorities of First Nations communities in some semblance of order that reflects their needs rather than impose priorities from the South, saying, now worry about climate change. It might be what we're worried about, but we better address all their other needs as well.
In another paper titled Integrated Prepositions for Adaptive Conservation Policy, co-authored with doctoral student Shannon Hagerman, Dr. Dolot Abadi clarifies how conservation policies can change over time.
The question has been, what we've had is land set asides and national parks and other kinds of approaches to isolating an area that we consider to be highly valuable because of its biodiversity. And by isolating it, say, from logging, what we've said is by isolating it, we are reducing the probability that those things within this region that we care about will be damaged.
Right.
Historically, it would have been logging. It would have been development. It would have been disturbances which are direct. But essentially from the second quarter of the 20th century onwards, we've had lots of disturbances due to distant forces. Acid rain was the first one that really became an important issue, where acid rain falls, 1,000 kilometers away from where the smokestacks emitted the sulfur dioxide. And more recently, impacts have been felt because of climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. The importance of this is that a boundary-setting approach won't protect your valued assets, because climate change doesn't sit there and say, oh, look, that's a national park. I'm going to leave the climate of the national park alone. Climate change occurs over all the landscape. And if the climate change is what stresses the valued asset disappears.
Okay.
So in adaptive conservation, the challenge is whether we stick to the notion that there are some things, some specific species that we need to protect because we value those species, or whether we come to a realization that our traditional approach of species protection won't work, and that what we actually need to do is to protect large biodiversity gradients, that the specific makeup of that ecosystem may change outside our control, but retaining a rich biodiversity has other features that are within our control. And to do that, most of what we've been doing for conservation policy needs to be turned on its head, because you don't go to the World Wildlife Federation and give them money because they say, we're going to protect biodiversity gradients. You go there because they say, we're going to protect the panda or the polar bear or very specific, very attractive fauna and flora. And so their public appeal for support has been based on species protection, mm-hmm. usually charismatic species protection.
Right.
What they will not be able to deliver on is that protection. So at the moment, we're living in a little bit of a bait and switch world in which the conservation agencies are baiting us with species protection, but actually not delivering it. And what we're really keen on is a more honest conversation between the general public and the conservation agencies, be they nonprofit agencies or other, that acknowledges what is within our control in terms of conservation and protection of diversity, and what is outside of that control. And let's promise what we can deliver and not promise what we can't.
And finally, in the conclusion of our conversation, Dr. Dolat Abadi sheds light on why he thinks adaptation to climate change will be so much more difficult than academics have been postulating.
Where do I begin? Because we're ill-equipped to adapt. I'll give you a good example. Low-lying areas are going to get flooded by sea level rise. Now, sea level rise is a natural consequence of climate change because as you warm up seawater, it expands, and so the level goes up. And as the big glaciers in the Arctic, in the Antarctic and Greenland melt, the sea level rises. So places like Richmond and Delta and so on will be experiencing higher and higher local sea levels and greater and greater probability of the seawall being breached and getting flooded. We really have an awful record of getting people who are at risk to move somewhere where they're not at risk. Usually, when people get flooded, what we do is we say, oh, there, how sad. We're going to give you emergency money to reestablish your life there. So for social and political reasons, we tend to put people back in the teeth of risk in some sense, right? We don't get them away from that risky location. A great example of it is most of New Orleans is below, 6 meters below sea level.
Mm-hmm.
The poorest people in New Orleans lived in District 6, I think it was. The fact that they lost their homes is regrettable. But if you're going to rebuild homes for them, for goodness sake, don't put it below sea level.
Right.
But the argument was made, this is the heart of New Orleans, right? These are the people of New Orleans, so let's locate them back where they were and try and recreate for them. This kind of nostalgic view of what New Orleans ought to be for centuries to come, putting them at greater and greater risk with every year of higher sea level rise and potentially more energetic storms. So we have this tendency not to respond effectively to these big events, which is one of the reasons why adaptation will be difficult. Others is that, so we don't respond well to extreme events because what we tend to do is to try and reestablish what we had before them.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't respond in the absence of extreme events because we think we're okay. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I had anticipatory adaptation, which said, we shouldn't be doing this because it's risky, I can't persuade anyone to do it. They say, I'm safe, nothing's happened to me. Right? So I can't move them out when they haven't had a storm. And then when there is a storm, I say, oh, there, let me put you back where you were. Now, if we were able to kind of extricate ourselves from that vicious cycle, we'd be fine. But politically and socially, we don't seem to be doing it. And there's lots of evidence that that's going to just cost us. There is a much greater tendency for people to be willing to do other stuff and to adopt other approaches, or it's much easier to persuade them to behave more effectively. And a really good example of how effective our intervention programs can be is the programs that they launched in Bangladesh in response to cyclones. You know, a typical cyclone would hit Bangladesh and kill 100,000 people. And then they realized what they needed was to produce refuges, which would be kind of higher ground that people could move to, and if there was a forecast of a cyclone, landfall. And they put refuges up there so people could run up to them. And they put in radio announcements about impending cyclones, and they still lost a lot of people. Then they realized that what was really important was to save people's cows. So they produced enough space for the cows to go up high. And now there's a cyclone and hardly anyone dies. So it's you've got to understand where the leverage on behavior is.
Right.
And
right.
once you understand the leverage on behavior, everything else falls into place. Mm-hmm. We often make mistakes of false associations in that case. So I'll give you another example. Another area I work in is malaria and the impact of climate change on malaria. There's a lot of stuff about that, and a lot of people, for example, used highland malaria in Africa as a signal that it used to be cool in highland areas. Now we have malaria, and we didn't have malaria before, so it must be because of climate change. It turns out there's a lot more cattle theft in highlands in various African countries. And people are bringing their cattle into their homes, right? And by bringing the cattle into their homes, they're raising the temperature inside the hut. And there is a lot of malaria now, malaria transmission, because the temperature inside the hut is high, and also because mosquitoes that feed on cattle and humans together are able now to effectively transmit malaria between hosts of different species. You've got to understand all of these relationships before you start making proclamations about what's actually going on or intervening effectively.
Listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Dolot Obadi's research and the College for Interdisciplinary Studies, you can visit their website at www.cfis.ubc.ca. You're listening to a piano piece by Chopin, performed by Professor Emeritus Robert Silverman from the UBC School of Music. He will be a guest on Prof Talk in the coming weeks. Next Tuesday, Professor Ira Nadell from the Department of English will be on our show, discussing his current biography of the American popular writer and author of Exodus, Leon Uris. We'd love to hear your comments, so please email us at proftalk@gmail.com or visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And you can hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farah Khan. Talk to you next week. Bye for now.
Best in bluegrass music, plus classic country, Cajun, rockabilly, western swing, and whatever jumps off the shelves at us. Tune in every Tuesday morning at 6:30 for Pacific Pickin' with your host, Arthur Berman.
And I'm Andrea.
The lovely Andrea, who will also provide you with our concert calendar and every bit of news and information you can possibly need. And as if that wasn't enough, there's a warm-up show at 6 featuring a little bit of a wider variety of roots and branches of bluegrass music. So tune in each morning, 6 for the warm-up show, 6:30 for the main show, Pacific Pickin' on
CITR
101.9 in Vancouver.
Hey, this. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR Vancouver. It's whatever. Hip hop, R&B, jazz. It's whatever. Reggae, soul, mainstream. It's whatever news, sports, and entertainment.
This is Steve Nash. You're listening to CITR 101.9, the home of the UBC Thunderbirds.